Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been 2 years since California launched a task force recognizing the legacy of harm that slavery has had on the state and to take steps to atone for that painful history. Part of that includes pinpointing a dollar amount for reparations, for generational pain spanning disproportionate rates of incarceration, to housing discrimination, and health disparities experienced by Black Californians throughout the decades. That was largely the focus of the Reparation Task Force meeting, the most recent one that took place in Southern California and Los Angeles. The task force currently has less than a year to complete its work, and there are many logistical and political challenges left to untangle, including a bill allowing the task force to extend their 2023 deadline that is sparking a contentious debate in and of itself. Annalise Finney is a reporter with KQED in the Bay Area and has been reporting on the task force for the past year and joins us to get us up to speed on where things stand now. Annalise, good morning. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
So the most recent meeting took place over 2 days in Los Angeles. What was the focus and what was achieved?
Right. So as you said, this is kind of the beginning of the second year of the task force's work. Last year in June, they released a report that basically answered the question, why are reparations necessary in California? It dug into the history of Black discrimination against the Black community, sort of starting with slavery, but then really focusing in on government policies in California that have perpetuated racism within our state. So that was kind of step one. And this task force meeting this past weekend marked the beginning of phase two. So that means the task force is really digging into this question of, okay, so we know reparations are necessary. What should they look like? And that's a really big question. So this task force, they specifically were looking at other places where reparations have happened to understand, you know, what could this look like? And they also focused on making a plan for the next year and hearing from the Black community about what people here in California would like to see themselves.
Yeah, and there was a robust turnout from the Black community during these meetings. It was packed with members from the public, and it was passionate, understandably. What was the mood and the energy of those who showed up, and what did they have to say?
There was a lot going on. There was kind of jubilation at the presence of so much community. I think this is the second task force meeting to be in person, so only the second time that people in the audience have been able to see each other and get a sense of, okay, this is a historic moment and we're here for it. Sort of in acknowledgement of that historic moment, there was a sense of pride in the room that, you know, California is the first state to take on reparations to the Black community at a statewide level. And people know when they're sitting there that they're witnessing history. There was also a determination to share their thoughts with the task force. I think the public really feels like, you know, if this is going to happen, it's not going to happen without our voices as part of it. And then, of course, underneath that, there was pain. I mean, this is about a history of racial discrimination that has impacted millions of people in our state. And one of the people who voiced that experience was a man named Milagro Jones. Milagro is an undergraduate student at UCLA and is the father of a young daughter. He made a public comment on the first day and addressed the task force.
I just want to say I'm a human being, yo. And I'm tired of being treated like this because I'm Black. I'm sick and tired of being treated like this because I'm Black. Me and my daughter, we're human beings. I don't know nothing about the bills, the politics, Obama, none of that. I just know what's going on in the streets. I know what it's like when you leave your home every day, you're scared if you pull out a phone, you'll get robbed and killed for a phone because everybody around you is so poor and everybody got to bang and sell dope just to survive. I'm tired of living like this, yo. I don't know what the reparations is all about, but I know y'all could change this. I know our communities have been neglected for years and years and years.
Yeah, that was just so powerful and so painful. And Milagro wasn't alone in this. I mean, you listened to so many other voices. What else did they have to say about this process?
Right. So the task force, like I mentioned, is discussing a bunch of different ideas about what reparations could look like. And a lot of people who spoke at the task force shared their vision for what reparations should be. And one of those people was retired Professor Emeritus Joyce Faye Allen Hamilton, who was at the task force with her two sisters.
God has chosen you to help create the blueprint for reparation. Reparation is a check owed to Black Americans for the enslavement of ancestors that must not bounce, but must be cashed upon receiving it.
Yeah, that was also a powerful comment. And the task force heard similar sentiments from other people, like activist Chris Lodgson, who was there with the Coalition for a Just and Equitable California.
When you are developing this reparations plan over the next year, as you're going to do, we want cash money. We want money. Income. Cash. Wealth. We want it. It was stolen. We work for it. It's old.
So let's talk about those potential payments that the reparations task force is considering. They discussed the possibility of cash payments for individuals who are descendants of slavery before 1900. What are some of the models the task force is considering?
Right. So cash payments are one of a bunch of different models the task force is looking at. They haven't made any decision yet, and what they ultimately recommend might include sort of a bunch of different things together. It might include financial programs like loan forgiveness or free college tuition. It might include direct payments like we've been hearing about. And it might include other non-monetary measures like changes in state curriculum or the creation of new monuments. But like you said, they are considering cash payments. And in order to do so, they're working with a team of economists to get a sense of kind of what cash payments could look like and to put a number on how much racist policies have cost Californians. So specifically, they're using what they're calling a harms model. That means they're looking at a specific set of discriminatory policies and quantifying the economic impact of those policies on the Black community. So the five groups of harms that they're starting with are, first, unjust property takings by eminent domain. Second, the devaluation of Black businesses. Third, housing discrimination and homelessness. Fourth, the disproportionate mass incarceration and over-policing of Black people. And finally, fifth, health harms. Now, this is obviously not an all-inclusive list of the ways in which the state of California has harmed the Black community, but it's just a starting point. And they're starting here because these are the kind of issues that the task force identified that have the most easily accessible data that the economists can use to base their calculations on. So just to give you a sense of how these calculations work, I'll break down one. The task force, like I said before, was looking at health harms to the Black community. And in order to put a dollar amount on that, they looked at the statistical value of life in the United States. Now, this is kind of weird, but the statistical value of a life in the U.S. is $10 million. Doesn't mean that everybody has
$10 million. Okay, yeah.
But that's kind of what statisticians say is the value of a life, if you're going to put it in a monetary number. So the economists took that number and they divided that by the average life expectancy for Black people in California. Now, in California, Black people have some of the lowest life. They have the lowest life expectancy of any racial group in the state. Their life expectancy is 7.5 years shorter than their white counterparts. And it comes out to 78.5 years of life expectancy. So these economists took that $10 million life value number. They divided it by 78 and a half, which comes out to around $130,000 per year of life expectancy. So if you multiply that by the number of years, it comes out to just short of $1 million for Black people who spend their whole lives in California.
Wow. So just shy of $1 million. You know, obviously this hasn't been done before when we're talking about reparations, not only in the United States, but also globally. And so there also were experts on international reparations efforts. It also took place in this meeting. What did the task force learn from them?
Right. So like you said, they wanted to hear about places where reparations have happened before. And they heard from experts who talked about a few different case studies. One they talked about was in Canada, where reparations are being paid to Native people who were forced to live in residential schools. And the way the reparations program has played out in part in Canada is that people have been given a lump sum if they were a student at a residential school. And for people who experienced extreme sexual or physical abuse, there's also the ability to apply for additional compensation. In Chile, where reparations are being paid to victims of human rights abuses during the 1970s and 80s dictatorship by Augusto Pinochet, people are paid sort of like the reparations comes as pensions, essentially. So people are still being paid out to this day reparations, and reparations there also included free healthcare for people who had survived torture. So those are the models they looked at. But another reason that there were experts there on international reparations is because whatever recommendations the task force makes, it has to comply with international law around reparations. So the UN defines reparations as having five components. The first component is the assurance of non-repetition and the cessation of harmful action. So essentially stopping doing the things that are harming people. The second thing that's required is restitution. So that means returning people to the state that they were in before the harm began. And then there's compensation, which can sometimes mean paying kind of for the emotional damage or other damage that isn't covered in restitution. Then there's satisfaction, which typically tends to address a more emotional side of the damage. So sometimes that includes official apologies, monuments, things of that nature. But essentially, the goal is to make the harmed community feel satisfied with the type of reparation they're receiving. And then finally, rehabilitation. So whatever the task force comes up with, it has to conform with those five laws. And that's sort of part of a wider thing that's happening here, where, you know, the reparations plan has to conform with national law. It has to conform with international law. And most recently, the UN has been beginning to put a little bit more pressure on the US to meet some of the standards that they're holding other countries to when it comes to ending racial discrimination. This past summer, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination specifically called out the US and said they're not doing enough to provide reparations to the descendants of enslaved people here.
Okay, so there's that pressure as well as international standards set by the United Nations. And then also researchers at UCLA actually conducted a community engagement survey to really examine public opinion on reparations in California. What did they learn?
Right. So there's also the pressure of making sure that whatever they come up with is tailored to what people in California need and want. So like you said, UCLA conducted this community engagement survey, and what they found was that at a base level, there is a clear desire for reparations. Here's UCLA professor Michael Stoll on that point.
All desire acknowledgement of these harms. All desire some recognition of the extreme disproportionate, historically unique experiences of African Americans, even in California, and they all uniformly want remedy of some sort.
So what that remedy should look like depends on what people want to an extent. And UCLA found that cash payments were the clear preference of Black Californians. They also found that statewide, a majority of people surveyed supported cash payments, but there was even more support for non-cash monetary programs like loan forgiveness, universal basic income, free college tuition, things like that. Interestingly, they found that within the state, support for reparations is the highest among people who are under the age of 45, and support is also higher among women than men.
Yeah, and this has been done before. The task force also heard from Japanese American activists about how their community came together to successfully win reparations from the U.S. government for survivors of internment camps during World War II. Did you find parallels for their own fight for reparations to what's taking place right now?
Yeah, so the activists who presented to the task force were very careful to acknowledge that their experience is obviously different than that of the Black community. But they did highlight a few things that they thought were important in their experience that they wanted to share with the task force and with the community present to know about kind of what reparations might look like as it makes its way through the legislative process. And one of the first things they talked about was the importance of personal testimony. As part of the reparations process for Japanese Americans, 10 hearings were held around the United States where people from the Japanese American community were invited to give testimony about what they had experienced during their internment during World War II. And Maya Iwataki was one of those activists and described the impact of those testimonies.
It was the opportunity for our people to stand up, stand together and speak out, and it unified our community. Those testimonies put a spotlight on the role and the character of the United States government.
So those types of hearings that she's describing and that impact she's describing is a little different than what's been happening at the task force so far. So far, they've had an hour of public comment at the beginning of every meeting, but the majority of the meeting has been designated to task force business. And at the end of this meeting, this past weekend, the task force discussed the possibility of holding public hearings that would be multiple hours to just hear personal stories from the community about what these policies have meant in their lives. So it remains to be seen if those will be scheduled, but it's something that's potentially coming up in the future. Nia also talked about what happens after recommendations for reparations are made. In the case of Japanese American reparations, years passed between when recommendations were made and when the reparations bill was passed in Congress. And during that time, members of the Japanese American community were lobbying hard for legislators to support the reparations bill.
These were folks from all walks of life: gardeners, doctors, attorneys, truck drivers, students, elders. These people saved up their money and saved up their vacation time and went to Washington, D.C. to fight for justice and redress.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with KQED reporter Annalise Finney about the latest California Reparations Task Force meeting. Annalise, during public comment, the issue of who from California's Black community will be eligible for reparations came up again. It has been a point of contention ever since the task force decision this past spring to limit who is eligible. Can you explain why this issue keeps coming up, and how has the task force addressed it?
Yeah, so last March, the task force decided in a 5-4 vote to limit reparations to people who can prove a link to people who were enslaved. So essentially, are the descendants of enslaved ancestors. And essentially, the task force has made their decision. They haven't given any indication that they're going to change that eligibility choice. But the topic keeps coming up in public comment. And it's something that is very emotional for a lot of people, because obviously, if you are Black, it doesn't matter whether your family emigrated in the 1950s or whether they were brought over as people who were enslaved. You still might be targeted by the police. You still might be subject to over-incarceration or experience redlining as you try to get a home mortgage. Mm. So there's some back and forth about this, but a large part of why the task force decided to vote the way they did was because they'd received legal advice that because of the 14th Amendment, a race-based reparations plan might be subject to extra scrutiny in the courts and might ultimately be thrown out in court. And they want to make sure some type of reparation happens. It's sort of what one task force member, Donald Tamaki, calls rough justice. It's not perfect, but here's maybe something that we can get done.
Given that the task force is now halfway through its 2-year charter, what's left to do? I mean, it seems like a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. I mean, they have 9 months to come up with a comprehensive reparations plan. They're working with experts and with staff members and attorneys from the Department of Justice to make that plan. But it's a lot. They have split this past meeting. They decided to split into a few advisory committees to address particular issues. But they certainly have a lot of work ahead of them, and it's going to be a very busy year.
Yeah, I mean, the last minute or two that we have, I mean, one of the task force members, State Senator Stephen Bradford, told the public during the hearing that it would be a major hurdle to pass any reparations plans at the state legislature. I found that surprising, given the task force is the product of legislation, Assembly Bill 3121 back in 2020. So is he saying this work may ultimately hit a dead end?
Well, I think he's acknowledging that they have a challenge ahead of them, that the task force charter is to make a recommendation for reparations. They're on track to do that, even though it's going to be a lot of work, but that's just a recommendation. The legislature then has to vote on it, approve it, and fund it in the budget in order for reparations to become a reality for Californians. And I think he's acknowledging that that's going to be hard. I mean, the Black population in California is just under 7% of the state. It's a rather small community. And they're going to need allies in order to pass that, because their majority of legislators just don't have a large Black constituency. Japanese Americans who spoke at the meeting also emphasized the importance of allies in their fight and said that they are excited and willing to be allies to the Black community as they fight for their reparations.
Finally, as a reporter who's been covering the task force since its inception, what stands out to you about how things are progressing?
Well, I think it's exciting to see the public becoming more engaged. I think the first year of this task force sort of labored in private or in the dark. People didn't know about it as much. And slowly these meetings are beginning to become more filled. I'm hearing more conversations about this. And given that it's such a historic thing, I find that exciting. Another thing that I think I've noticed and am seeing more and more, especially as they gear up for this heavy year of work coming up, is that the task force is working for free. All the people on the task force have other full-time jobs, they have families, and the next month is going to be a ton of work for them. The people who are there believe that reparations is something that California needs. And so I just am impressed by their work, and I'm excited to continue to see it happen.
Still a lot for you to follow, too. Annalise Finney is a reporter for KQED. Thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thanks, Vicky.
Annalise was bringing us up to speed on the latest on California's reparations task force. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.